This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Michigan Campaign Finance Network Director Rich Robinson breaks down some of the money spent on this fall's election, and he tells us why some of the contributions remain hidden from public scrutiny. But first, public health officials warn that Michigan is putting itself at risk. That is one of the major takeaways from a series of stories in the Kalamazoo Gazette on school children not being vaccinated against common diseases such as measles. Kalamazoo Gazette reporter Julie Mack worked on this series, and she joins us. Julie Mack, thank you for being here.
Good morning, Evans. Glad to be here.
Let's begin with how the series kind of got started, its roots. Why did the reporters and editors, including yourself at the Kalamazoo Gazette, say we need to take a look at vaccinations?
Really, this was an idea of editor out of Ann Arbor. This is actually a statewide project. It wasn't just in the Kalamazoo Gazette. It was in all the newspapers in our chain. She saw a controversy over vaccinations, I think, at her child's school, and thought it would be interesting to look at statewide. So it was assigned to a team in Kalamazoo because I'm used to crunching a lot of data, and my colleague, Rosemary Parker, who worked on it, has written a lot about this issue and knows a lot about public health issues.
If we look at the trend line, do we see an increase in parents in Michigan deciding that their children are not going to be vaccinated?
We didn't see a lot of historical data, but I was able to look at CDC reports going back to the 2009-2010 school year. And yes, we definitely saw that it's gone up by 23% during that time.
You do have a geographic breakdown of the places in the state where it's more likely that children have not been vaccinated. What does this tell us?
Well, I think that it tells you that you really can't look at statewide waiver rates and vaccination rates, that it's very specific to schools, it's very specific to districts, it's very specific to counties. You have a lot of factors at work, including cultural factors of, you know, whether or not the parents are on board with the idea of immunization or whether or not you have a community of parents that really eschew immunizations.
And can we say find some common threads there where we can say that there are certain characteristics?
Oh, yes. I mean, I found three trends when I was looking at the data. One is that actually this area, the southwest part of the state and the Grand Rapids area, so the west side of the state, was much better immunized than the east side of the state. Some of the highest counties in terms of waiver rates, that would be parents who are opting out, were in Metro Detroit. And they were not the poor communities, they were the richer communities. So that was the second trend was, actually, poor kids tend to be immunized. And a lot of times, the parents who are opting out are the well-educated, affluent communities. And another trend which plays into that is private schools are much less likely to have high immunization rates than public schools.
You mentioned getting a waiver. Explain how someone, if they want to, can get a waiver, which allows them to send their child to school without the vaccinations that most kids receive.
This is an interesting point, and it's something that Rosemary knew right out of the gate, and that helped shape our narrative, that many people perceive that immunizations are mandatory in Michigan for school children. That's often the way that it's termed. In fact, they are not mandatory, and it's very, very easy to get out of them. You just sign a form. You can actually, up until recently, just put on a piece of paper, I don't want my kid immunized, and you're out of those regulations. So I think for a lot of people, that's shocking, that it's extremely easy to scooch out of this.
And is that changing?
Yes, it is. Actually, as we were reporting this, it turned out the State Department of Health was revamping its rules. And while the state says you have to offer exemption to parents if you don't want it, there's lots of studies in other states, and actually in Michigan, that have found that if you don't make it convenient, less parents are going to choose that option. If you make parents, for instance, get the statement notarized, if you make parents go to the health department to pick up the form, if you make them sit through a half-hour talk about why kids should be immunized, those all can dramatically decrease the waiver rate.
Grand Traverse County has one of the higher rates in the state of children who have not been vaccinated, and now there is an outbreak there. Are health officials pretty sure that that is what has caused an outbreak of measles in Grand Traverse County?
Yes, they say it's not coincidental. Well, and all the people who got measles are not vaccinated. And the measles vaccine is very effective. It's like 99.9. So, you know, the chances are highly likely. You wouldn't have any measles cases if those people had been vaccinated. One interesting thing about Grand Traverse is I actually went through the lists of county in October and actually went through the State Department reports and went building by building and compiled a list of all the schools that were vulnerable. And the charter school that where the outbreak started was on my list. And I have a daughter who lives in Traverse City. I had mentioned to her, Traverse City is really vulnerable to a disease outbreak. And you've got a bunch of schools in there that, this could really happen. And 2 weeks later, she called me and said, guess what? It had happened. And so it wasn't really surprising.
At the same time, we've just heard now that in Hamilton, in Allegan County, there is an outbreak there of whooping cough. But it seems that there's some difference here between what's going on in Grand Traverse County and Allegan County. How do these two things play out differently?
They're playing a lot differently. In Traverse City, this started at a charter school where you had only 80-ish percent of the kids were immunized. A lot of kids had waivers. So you had, in a school of about 1,200 kids, you had about 150 cases of whooping cough in about a 2-3 week period. It just raced through the school because you had a lot of unvaccinated kids. Now, the whooping cough vaccine does not confer 100% immunization. You can definitely catch whooping cough, a bit of milder form, even if you're immunized. And there were some kids at Grand Traverse who were immunized, still got sick. But you were much more likely to get sick, 5 times more likely to get sick if you were unvaccinated at that school. So let's compare that to Hamilton. In Hamilton, it's twice the size of the charter school. You have far fewer cases, 20-some. And the difference, that disparity, the 20-some versus 150, experts are telling us, that's the difference in vaccination rates.
You just brought up the fact that there are some people who have been vaccinated and yet still got some form of whooping cough.
Right.
And I guess that's a point that really needs to be stressed here, because I can imagine some people starting your series in the Gazette, maybe listening to us speak here and say, my kids have been vaccinated. I feel bad for somebody else's kid if they get the measles. But hey, if my kid's vaccinated, it's not a problem. But that's not exactly correct, is it?
And I started this series with that assumption in mind, that this was a problem that was really limited to those kids and those families. And I found out that this is really a much bigger issue, and it really does affect everybody in the community. There is a concept called herd immunity. First of all, there's some people in any community who cannot be vaccinated. You have babies that are too young. You have elderly people who are much more vulnerable to disease. You have people on chemotherapy. You have some people where the vaccination, no vaccine is 100%. So there are some where they're not fully immunized against a disease. So you want to have high vaccination rates simply from this idea of herd immunity, that a disease cannot take hold. And you could see the herd immunity concept play out in the Traverse City situation and the Hamilton and Allegan County situation.
When there is the herd concept of immunity, there may be some sort of an outbreak, but it's going to be much less severe and much more contained.
Exactly. And there have been studies done. The pertussis vaccine, the whooping cough vaccine, is somewhat notorious for the fact that you can be vaccinated and still have outbreaks. But they have done numerous studies in recent years in which the under-vaccinated communities are much more likely to have a pertussis outbreak, and it's much more likely to involve more people.
So state health officials, when they're looking at this, they see it as a broader public health issue than just the kids who don't get vaccinated.
Oh, absolutely. They are, and once again, you go back to Traverse City. That is a perfect example of people getting sucked into this who had done all the right things, and they're still getting sick. I have a niece who is a doctor in Grand Rapids. She deals with a lot of babies. Those babies are all vulnerable to whooping cough simply by their age, even if their parents are doing all the right thing. And think of how terrifying it would be to have a 2-month-old infant in a community where there's a whooping cough outbreak, because 50% of the kids who get whooping cough end up in the hospital. And that's the age where they're most likely to die.
You did talk to some people who choose not to vaccinate their children. What do they say when presented with, some of the things that you just spelled out here, that it is a public health issue and that they are putting other people at risk?
Well, they don't buy the argument. They really don't. And they do tend to be well-educated people. They tend to be middle class or affluent. They are people who tend to be very skeptical of the Western medicine. They're usually people who are very into holistic medicine? I mean, basically, if you had to sort of, I talked to a half a dozen families, and sort of the standard profile was the mom who shops at Whole Foods or, you know, will not buy genetically modified foods, is very skeptical about giving her child antibiotics, is very into alternative health versus Western medicine. And they simply see vaccines as sort of big pharma. This is arrogant doctors trying to shove things down your throat. And there's a lot on the internet that reinforces that view.
What do they see as the danger of being vaccinated?
Well, they do think that that hasn't been studied enough and that there is a danger of long-term neurological issues, even though the autism thing has been debunked. I mean, and it has been thoroughly debunked. And there is no mainstream group that supports the idea that vaccines are dangerous, none that I could find. And no studies in peer-reviewed journals that, you know, have been, they're reinforcing that. You can find a lot on the internet that just says this is a bunch of bunk and this is, and it's sort of like talking to people who don't believe in climate change. I mean, it's almost exactly the same. It's not really a scientific argument. It is an emotional argument.
You do start off, though, one story with a woman named Gretchen Perry.
Right.
And she says that her children's health improved after she swore off vaccines. The children had a lot of health problems, and then she stopped vaccinating them. Now, we need to say here, correlation does not always equal causation. At the same time, that is somewhat compelling for a parent, isn't it, to say, hey, look, you know, my kids were not feeling well. They feel better without vaccines. Are there little anecdotal stories like that out there that kind of feed into this movement?
Oh, sure. And she was definitely one of them. Now, most of the people that I talked to had read stories like her. I mean, they didn't have her experience. But I definitely think that there are people who, you know, they hear those stories about long-term damage, and it just scares the bejesus out of them. And they've never seen anyone who's had measles or mumps or some of these other diseases. So they see that, you know, a lot of kids who have autism, you don't know anybody who's ever had measles. What's the more scary thing to you?
And I suppose they can also point to what we mentioned earlier, that the vaccine's not 100% effective. So when somebody who was vaccinated then gets whooping cough, do they have one more argument to make?
Oh, and that's that is the slam dunk argument they feel right now in Traverse City. The people who are very skeptical of vaccines in Traverse City is like, well, people are getting sick regardless, so why are people jumping down our throats? But one thing to remember here is that one reason the people who are skeptical are not afraid of measles or not afraid of whooping cough or not afraid of a lot of these diseases is because vaccines have been so effective in wiping out diseases that were once rampant in our society.
I want to give you an opportunity to address this issue because I read it in the comments of the Gazette section. I normally don't like to go to the comment section of any news website to go for ideas for interviews. But there were a lot of people questioning the whole idea of putting people in this story who were saying that they don't vaccinate their children, wondering if you were not giving voice to a theory that's not supported by science and perhaps putting some dangerous information out there. You responded to those readers in the comment section, but let me have you respond here as well.
Well, the fact is, the central premise of this story is that people who are getting waivers, I mean, we were very focused on the waiver rates. That was a central issue in this story. It seems absurd to me as a journalist not to talk to parents who are getting waivers to find out, where are you coming from? Why would you do this? What is your thinking about this? I think that people in today's media society often are hearing one-sided news reports, and they're only hearing about the detractors through the filter of a commentator, of a biased commentator. So they're somewhat taken aback when someone does give detractors actually a voice. I do think that we were very careful to give them a voice, but also to say, but here is the science, and make it really clear the science isn't really backing those views at all, or the statistics. I mean, there are statistics on how many people get vaccinated, how many people have adverse effects. The adverse effects are teeny. Like last year, you know, a couple hundred people were able to collect from a federal program in which compensates people who had a serious consequence from a vaccine. It was about 300. 100 million people, more than 100 million people get a vaccine every year. And actually, someone pointed out to me yesterday that most of the people who are settling on claims, those are not childhood vaccines. Those are adults with flu vaccines that are having a reaction to the flu vaccine. And thousands of people die every year still from vaccine-preventable diseases. And that's clear, too, from hepatitis, from pneumonia, from meningitis, flu. You know, there are lots of deaths that could be prevented by vaccines. And you weigh that against, you know, the fact that there are, in very rare instances, you do have people who have an adverse reaction to the shot.
So we mentioned earlier some of the changes being made in getting a waiver. Do health officials in the state have any other plans, a strategy for trying to increase vaccinations or trying to eliminate the percentage, however small it is, of people who are choosing not to have their children vaccinated, public information campaigns, those sort of things?
Oh, yeah. And I think a lot of it is talking to parents one by one. In Kalamazoo County, they actually were one of the ones that led the way on the let's make it a little harder to get these waivers. And they started since 2010. You have to go to the health department. You have to talk to someone. And they'll sort of talk through it before you sign the form. And that's not going to change someone who says no way, no how. But it does change the mind of someone who said, well, I couldn't afford it, and I didn't realize that there were special programs if your insurance won't cover it. Someone who maybe had heard some things but was willing to be convinced. It did change a lot of minds off the fence. It's one reason that Kalamazoo County actually has one of the lowest waiver rates in the state.
Julie Mack, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Kalamazoo Gazette reporter Julie Mack. You can read the series on vaccinations in the state at mlive.com. There's also a link available at our website, wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The votes have been counted in Michigan's November election, and in the case of at least the state Senate race in Kalamazoo County, counted again. The Michigan Campaign Finance Network has been trying to figure out where the money came from before those votes were cast. Rich Robinson is director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Gordon.
On your website, you start off the analysis of where the money came from in various races by saying that Michigan is the dark money capital of American politics. What makes it so?
Well, the high percentage of the money raised and spent, particularly in the executive campaigns, the Supreme Court campaign, much more so than the legislative races. It's in the statewide races. But nearly half of all money spent in the Supreme Court campaign was off the books, and that's been the case this entire century. A significant amount of the spending in the attorney general race, most of the ads that were seen about Bill Schuette this fall were paid for by a 527 committee called Michigan Advocacy Trust that doesn't report its receipts and expenditures. And then in the gubernatorial race, about two-thirds of the money that was in that campaign was independent groups. Not all of that what you'd call completely dark money, but nearly all of it entities that didn't report their activity at all to the state of Michigan. So the state of Michigan has a particularly lame posture where it comes to requiring accountability for political campaign spending.
Specifically on the governor's race, you describe a $40 million accountability gap. Explain what that means.
Well, that is the point I was making, that all this television advertising, and by far most of the television advertising, was paid for by the Republican Governors Association and the Democratic Governors Association, was not reported at all to the state of Michigan. The state of Michigan says if you don't explicitly say vote for or against a candidate, you haven't made a campaign expenditure. Now, I don't know why we would think these partisan governors' associations or political parties would be spending money on television other than to influence the votes of of citizens, but that's the position the state of Michigan has taken. And so all of this advertising is absent from the official record that the state of Michigan has online. And I was able to compile most of this record by going through the public files of the state broadcasters and cable systems. So it's a huge part. I mean, two-thirds of this campaign that isn't part of the public record in the state of Michigan. And I think that is a huge accountability gap.
Looking at the legislative races, the 20th District State Senate race here in Kalamazoo County was the most expensive. By how wide a margin was it the most expensive in Michigan?
Well, by nearly $1 million. It was just far and away the most expensive race, state Senate race, anywhere in Michigan this election cycle. Just by a wide margin, more expensive. And the interesting thing about it is that most of that money is coming from the legislative caucus PACs and the political parties, either in-kind contributions, which means the caucus PAC buys the advertising, or independent expenditures that really aren't independent in any meaningful way, because Michigan law allows a state or an independent spender to coordinate with a campaign committee. It just can't be under the control of the candidate. So much like the federal campaigns, these things are being centralized in the way the money is raised and spent. And local fundraising by the candidate committees is a diminishing factor in the whole thing. So I don't know what that means for the connectedness between constituents and the public officials who represent them. It seems to me it's a bit of a break in that connection.
And the parties are pretty attuned to which districts are the most competitive. And so does that lead to the district which here is in Kalamazoo County, the 20th State Senate District, getting so much more money because they realize that there is a chance that either candidate could win? As a matter of fact, we ended up with a 61-vote margin at the end of the day. So is that why that money is coming from the parties? They know pretty well which districts are going to be more competitive than others.
Absolutely, that's right, Gordon. And the way they calculate that is they look at what they consider to be the party base votes, and they don't make that calculation based on the top of the ticket, because there are ticket splitters at the top of the ticket. But they look at the statewide education boards, the governing bodies for the University of Michigan, Michigan State, and Wayne State, and the State Board of Education, because the assumption there is the citizens don't know who these candidates are, and it's those seats where they plunk their underlying party preference. And so the parties look at that. They have that broken down to the voting precinct and their expectation of what a base vote is, and they know exactly where the competition will be. And conversely, they know exactly where the competition will not be. And that was one of the striking things to me about going through these end-of-cycle data. Really, what we have is in a third of the legislative districts, both state House and state Senate, one major party candidate or the other major party's candidate doesn't even bother to raise money. It's a foregone conclusion that they can't compete. And that's partly a function of the big sort, you know, how people choose to live in different places, but it's partly a function of gerrymandering, too.
The 61st State House District, which includes the city of Portage, saw the Republican Brand Iden defeat Democrat John Fisher, even though Fisher actually ended up raising and spending more money. But how rare is it that the winning candidate is outspent?
It is extremely rare. There were only three in this election cycle in the state House who managed to defeat a candidate with greater financial backing. There were none in the state Senate. So two things that are generally strong predictors of success are incumbency and the advantage in financing. And of course, the 61st was an open seat, so you didn't have that in play. One of the things that I'd note about that was an awful lot of the spending for Fisher came through in-kind contributions from the AUKUS PAC. It was not locally raised money to a very great extent. And so it wasn't reflective, I don't think, of the underlying closeness of support by constituents that translated into financial support for the candidate. So in a sense, it was an outsider's bet, and it turned out not to come through.
The candidate committees for state Supreme Court, as you noted earlier, they accounted for less than half of all the spending in that race. And as you say, that's a pattern in Michigan. What do other states do when it comes to judicial elections, their state Supreme Courts, that makes it less dark or makes the election and the fundraising of it more transparent?
I think it's a convergence of a number of issues. One, we have an absolutely unique way of selecting candidates that is for what is ostensibly a nonpartisan position, and that is that they're nominees of the political parties. I think that tends to politicize it, and the great part of the outside spending and unreported spending this year was the Michigan Republican Party buying over $4 million worth of television ads supporting its slate of candidates, the incumbents Brian Zarin, David Viviano, and Judge James Redfield, or Redford, rather, from Grand Rapids. That's one of the factors, I think, is that it really is quite a partisan race. Another part of it, I think, is just the total failure to require accountability and transparency for where money is coming from in these political campaigns. Again, this is the technical factor. If you haven't said explicitly vote for or against this candidate, you haven't made a campaign ad. Well, you know, when the Republican Party buys $4 million worth of television ads in the month before the election to create these hagiographic messages about their candidates and how they're good for your life, I think we're kind of deliberately blinded here as to what's going on. And I think that if there is no accountability, you tend to draw out some spending that wouldn't be there if an anonymity wasn't afforded to them. It's hard to say how this has been perpetuated over time, Gordon. I mean, we've seen this in some other states, and that pattern has kind of played itself out. But that may be because one party has entirely captured the court. And generally, you don't see this kind of spending unless the majority might be at stake. It really wasn't this time around, but still the spending was there.
Do you see anything on the horizon, given the current makeup of the legislature, the governor's office, who the current Secretary of State is, Ruth Johnson, that makes you think that there is going to be any movement on campaign finance reform in the new session of the legislature, which begins in January?
I'm not optimistic at all, Gordon, and I'll tell you the reason is that we're in the position we're in not because good people have failed to do the right thing, but it's because there was an overtly hostile legislative action last December to prevent disclosure. And this was the case where Secretary of State Ruth Johnson had said she was going to revisit how we had interpreted the requirements for disclosure. And the legislature, or the Republicans in the legislature, immediately reacted to foreclose the idea that it could be possible to require disclosure of any ad that didn't say explicitly vote for or against. So given that that's been the posture of the Republicans and given their majorities in the legislature, I'm not looking forward to any positive action. I hope I'm wrong. I'd love to see myself proven wrong on this, but I'm not optimistic at all.
Rich Robinson, as always, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Rich Robinson is director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Links with more information and longer versions of interviews on West Southwest can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.